All right, just a quick reminder for you, and you've been hearing the adverts, and it's just so important that we raise as much money as we can for Donegal Cancer Flights and Services, the Bluestacks Special Needs Foundation and Huey's Corner. They're this year's chosen charities for our birthday fundraising drive. And tickets are just €10. And on March 14th, between 11 a.m. and 8 p.m, we're giving €1,000 away every hour. So we will be encouraging you on that day to donate as much as you can. Enter the cash competition, and what you know, and you're donating at the same time, right? But also, it's no harm getting your tickets done now. You've done a good thing in supporting these three great charities, and then you're in all nine draws for Friday. Doesn't that make sense? If you want to buy your tickets, go to our website right now, highlandradio.com. You can donate there and make a difference. And if you want to give us a call, you can as well. Not everyone wants to do the online, though there's no reason not to, because it is safe and secure, but it just suits people differently. So get your tickets for our €9,000 draws by giving us a call as well, 07491 25000. And if you want to call into us here at the radio station, we'd be more than happy to do that for you. And we'd love to raise a big chunk of cash to keep the services supported. The Donegal Cancer Flights and Services, the Bluestacks Special Needs Foundation, and Huey's Corner. All great. Huey's Corner, as I mentioned, it is a child and adolescent and adult counselling services in Carndonagh, and it was set up in the memory of Hugh Simpson. He passed away suddenly in 2011, and his parents recognised that there were no supports there really for his siblings to sort of help them through the grief and loss. And they established Huey's Corner, and it's going strong now. And we were chatting to a young lady last week who's availed of the services of Huey's Corner. And wow, in a year, her life has been turned around. She had had Lyme's disease and was out of school for a while and was having to deal with all of that. Got some counselling from Huey's Corner and is now back studying, has ambitions of going on, I think, into beauty, and why not? So that's the kind of work that these charities do in our community, and this is about all of us as a community rallying together and supporting each other. So get your tickets right now, if you wish, on the website highlandradio.com, and you're donating to Donegal Cancer Flights, Bluestack, Huey's Corner, but also you're in nine draws for €1,000, euro, quid, euro. Right, okay, let us see. I'm going to take a break now because I want to get to Paul Dunlop, Professor Paul Dunlop. He's got an interesting story as it relates to his situation and relate to others as well. So stay tuned for that. I'll take you back to 2017. Do you remember the devastating floods at Elm Park in Buncrana? And it was a story we covered for months, and we broadcast a show specifically from Inishowen to sort of highlight the plight of those families. And well, I mean, they're still dealing with that issue right now, but also throw into the mix defective concrete products, and it makes for an absolute nightmare. Among homeowners in Elm Park in Buncrana is a regular on this show, Professor Paul Dunlop. Professor, thank you so much for your time. How are you keeping?
I'm keeping okay. Keep it okay, Greg, thank you.
Yeah, it's just waves, isn't it? One thing after another.
Yeah. So, dealing with this particular problem is quite difficult. We've, as you sort of highlighted quite clearly, like many people are having quite a lot of stress trying to rebuild their home, got on a quite a complicated scheme to fix their defective concrete home. But we have got a double whammy where we're dealing with really serious flooding. And when I mean serious flooding, I mean floodwaters that have been confirmed to be flowing at approximately 130 tons of per second. It's really, really, really bad.
All of these homes, the houses flooded at that time, all have defective concrete blocks in it now.
All of them have defective concrete blocks. And that's not, I mean, you can see it anyway because it's been cracking. But, I mean, we've been on a bit of a journey with Office of Public Works, Department of Housing, and Donegal County Council. But back in 2024, last year, the Department of Housing says, you know, well, we have no evidence these houses are defective. So anybody who wants to join the scheme and maybe consider being relocated, which we can talk about, have to join the scheme. So they started that journey last March, and all of them meet the damage threshold. There were five homes that had to be tested. There were three of us were already on the scheme, and we've been given option one, a full demolition. So all of the homes that I'm talking about today are defective. And that's been confirmed as part of the government scheme.
All right. I'll catch up to that in a second, but just in terms of flood mitigation, because these houses were boarded up for quite some time, and I kind of lost track of the story a little bit. Is that, other than the defective concrete, is this area habitable now if the flood protection's been put in place?
No. So after 2017, basically what happened was that some people were out of their houses for about a year, as you were saying, and had a real arduous journey with insurance companies trying to get insurance claims so they could reinstate their home. Some were paying out quickly, some weren't paying out at all for quite a long time. But very long story short, the people who lost their homes got insurance claims through, and it was about 12 to 13 months before their homes were reinstated. And the average cost to get back in was around 80,000 to 90,000 euro to reinstate the home again. So everyone has moved back into their house again. At that time, after we flooded, we started quite a long campaign with the local TDs to try and get the flood relief measures. And that was announced, I think it was in 2020, Boxer Moran, who was the minister at the time, who's also now the minister again, sort of announced a flood scheme for Buncrana. At that stage, we were told that it would be about 4 years to design the scheme, do the background ecological work and the hydrological modelling the risk, and then the thing would be built. And there were four phases to the flood scheme, and that would take roughly sort of 4 years. Now, we are still in phase one of that scheme, and it's 5 years. So we knew then, as sort of 2020 unfolded, 2021, the houses were sort of, you could see the elements of cracking, and at that stage, people were taking their heads out of their sand and saying, you know, actually, we have an R issue too that needs resolved. Some of us joined the scheme. Some of us got approval for demolition. I was one of them. And then, so in October 2023, we went to Donegal County Council and the CFRAMS team. And we said, look, where is the flood scheme? Because we're about to knock our house down and we need to rebuild it again. And we can't do that at full risk of flooding. And that's when we heard the devastating news that the scheme was probably at least an hour 6 years away.
But look, there's probably an argument that these houses should never have been there in the first place. This is an opportunity perhaps to right that wrong. Yes. I don't think anyone, and we all pay tax, would see the logic in rebuilding homes. Because, I mean, obviously you have to have absolute faith in the flood mitigation plans. It would make a great deal of common sense to find a different site to relocate these properties. Would it be easy to get agreement amongst all homeowners, do you think, Paul, to relocate to one location? Or is the call to allow people to find, with assistance perhaps, individual sites for these properties? Because it does become more complex, I suppose, when you have a number of people involved. What suits you may not suit your neighbour, for an example.
Yeah, well, the details of that haven't been agreed. What we're trying to do at the moment is get them to agree that they'll do this. I can tell you what has happened. Donegal County Council officially wrote out to all of the homeowners who were impacted by both defective concrete and in the floodplain at Ellen Park and asked them what was their preferred option: engineered solutions to build walls around their homes or relocation. So i.e. you get removed out of there forever, which removes the risk of flooding to our lives and also our property. So all of us have asked for that at an official level, and that's been recorded by the council. The detail hasn't been worked out, so I don't know what that would look like. But we have said that if we are allowed to be relocated, then we'll sort ourselves out. So, you know, we're not asking the state to go and find us a site or anything like that. You know, if we were relocated, it would be up to us to do that. And we were happy to sort of try and relocate ourselves. But you are correct. You know, for us, it is complete madness for the Irish state to be funding. It's almost 3 million euro to rebuild 8 defective concrete homes in Elm Park. And then for the OPW to come back in again and then build walls around Elm Park to defend them. So our solution is by relocating us out of there, it'll actually save the state.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. The flood mitigation works would be only to protect these homes, is that correct?
Yes.
So if those homes are given up on, that money would perhaps not need to be spent. Okay.
Yeah. Now, there are different flood schemes happening in Donegal at the moment. The unique thing about Ellen Park is that in our flood cell, they can actually remove us out of that area and not put in any mitigation works or engineering walls, and it has no impact on the rest of the Bonkrana London flood scheme.
The problem here is, though, often, Paul, is getting the... And I think this talks to bureaucracy, and I don't use that word in a negative context, but it's about getting... whoever makes decisions around a table to see the logic of this.
Yes.
Because really what you're sitting here talking about us today is it is obviously it's going to benefit you, hopefully, and other families. But this is actually something that's benefiting the state. We're saying, look, we're living in these houses, right? Your work's ongoing, and God knows how many reports are costing $100,000 to figure out how to fix this problem. We're saying to you, we've got another problem here. It's the defective concrete. Stop what you're doing now. Let's get round a table. We can progress to get new homes, and you can save a bit of cash. It's just, it should be simpler to get the right people around a table, metaphorically, to figure out the logic of this. That you know, stop now. This is crazy what we're proposing here.
Yeah. I mean, and the thing about this, Greg, right, is that everybody I say this to, this is the actual right logical. It's actually a thing that's happening elsewhere around the world. Relocation is a real thing. We're rather than building defences and causing issues further downstream, you can move people away and out of danger. And the thing about this is that there is precedent for this. So OPW have done this on several occasions in different parts of Ireland. They've done it on the Shannon. They've done it in Galway. So by saying that they'll consider it or they won't do it, is wrong, because there is a precedent for moving people out of dangerous areas due to flooding. So if they've done it before, why can't they do it now? And that's all we're asking them to do.
I think just it's a slightly even more simpler than that, because I can't remember now, because you hear so many of these stories, but let's just say the scanner that was bought by the Arts Council.
Yes.
You know, a couple of $100,000 on that. It's sitting, not being used. There's parts of it over, and it's a 4 or 5 day story. Everyone is up in arms. This is crazy. What's going on in this country? And so here we have a situation that potentially we're investing millions in a flood defence programme to protect homes that we haven't actually even built yet, because they've got defective concrete in it.
Yeah.
If that story is a 3 or 4 day national story, right, in a proper country, this would be a 1 month story, because it's potentially the waste of money. It's an active life decision now, right? We're not speaking retrospectively and ordering but unfortunately, there's so much red tape and layers of bureaucracy in this country that we don't see it like that. We wait till it's happened. We get up to high dough because the scanner's in a shed somewhere. This is live right now. But very hard to articulate it that anyone cares.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, this is going to save the state several million euro. Simple as that. It solves two serious, really, really serious issues for us, because we've lost our homes already through flooding. We've lost the complete value of it. We've lost our homes through defective concrete blocks. I mean, our houses are in shocking state. They're not going to last the 5 or 6 years that we have to wait until this flood scheme arrives, if it does arrive, because it is a complex process to get a flood scheme through. All flood schemes in Ireland are delayed, and they are all over budget. Massively over budget. So them and saying that like if an estimated wall around Elm Park was going to be €1 million or €2 million, you can certainly say that that's going to escalate.
Going back, sorry, Paul, and I'll keep cutting across you, but it's just that some of this stuff has to be said. Going back after those floods, forget concrete at this point, right?
Yeah.
We were getting texts into this show saying, why should the state be spending a fortune to protect those houses? They should never have been built there in the first place. This is ridiculous. The people should be... People were angry, right, that even these houses were being looked at being protected. That was a different story then. Fast forward to now, and we're talking about actually rebuilding these houses in this hole and then spending the additional money flooding it. But it just seems now in this day and age, as I say,
I can't believe that we're in a situation where the Irish state are going to consider rebuilding homes on a floodplain now on this year, and then coming in and then defending them, rather than giving them what the people want, which is basically to get out of there, which makes sense, because the last time in 2017, my neighbour nearly lost her life. You know, I was stuck in the house for nearly 7 hours with 6 people who came in to rescue me. It was horrendous. This is not a normal level of flooding where a little bit of water comes around your house. You've got to think about white water rafting. That's what this looks like. This is extremely fast-flowing water. And, you know, we can't be in a situation where the state are saying, yeah, go ahead and rebuild. I mean, this goes against the EU flood directive, and it goes against the new county, Donegal County Council development plan. That, you know, we want out of there. There's no reason or rhyme for putting us in there, and it saves the state. I mean, the other thing about this too, which is wrong, is that since 2017, all of us have lost our flood insurance. So we have no flood insurance. So what's happening is that the state are asking us to rebuild our homes back down there again at full risk to us. And once we flood the house, the houses are lost again. So it's not to say that they're going to spend even millions to rebuild houses. We're spending rebuilding houses that could be lost again. So we're looking at, we're basically staying in the long-term homelessness. That's what's happening at Elm Park. So, you know, we just need the government. We've been told by officials in Donegal County Council that this needs a ministerial intervention. So the Minister for Office of Public Works and the new Minister for Housing need to come together, look at this and make a decision. Now, they're saying that they're going to wait until all the final test results are back from the laboratory analysis. They don't need that. I mean, that'll just tell you the detail. We know all the houses are defective. They've all been built by the same, at the same time, in the same blocks. They're all going to get the same sort of outcome. They're all falling apart. You know, basically, they need to come together very, very quickly and make a decision, because we're running out of time. Because
yeah, but the cost, we don't know the cost of how you progress flood schemes, but there are probably reports that are being commissioned right now that aren't needed, or that 60 grand's being spent on. This is, as I say, this is a live opportunity to save the state money rather than speaking about it retrospectively. But as I said before, sometimes it has to be something similar, like a security shed, a wall, or a scanner before people sort of realise that it's a controversy. Right, okay. You talked about a lot of things that it goes against. One of the big things it goes against is common sense. I think most people would agree. Yes. Right, we'll stay in touch, Paul. Thanks very much for your time. That's Professor Paul Dunlop there. Just in relation to the firefighters and the conversation we were having a little earlier on, because I was talking about political reaction to it and where our local representative stood in relation to backing or otherwise, Deputy Charles Ward has issued a statement saying, "I stand in full support of the firefighters of Letterkenny Fire Station as they fight against the proposed cuts that threaten the safety of the local community." And we focused because of the guests that we had on Letterkenny, but there are also great concerns as it relates to the situation in Buncrana as well. On the issue of Elm Park, Donegal County Council knew it was a floodplain. Why did they grant the original permission? Second one here, the Elm Park residents should note what happened for Priory Hall residents. They were permitted to move their mortgages to another property. We need a multi-stakeholder working group to include bankers, insurers, engineers, law society, along with Department of Housing, to work through all these issues. The government DCB scheme was set up without joined-up thinking, but we just need to get, I think, more joined-up thinking right across the board, just in terms of whoever's responsible for the flood plan, whoever's responsible for defective concrete blocks, whoever's responsible from the local authority, and whoever's responsible for housing, and say, right, logically, we've got these houses in the hole. They've got defective concrete now. We are proposing to spend millions rebuilding them, and then we're going to have to spend millions building a wall around to protect them. We're not actually having to evict the people in these houses because they seem to actually want to move out of them. They don't see the sense in this. We'll move them somewhere else or support them in moving somewhere else. We'll not put in the flood defences because they aren't needed. The families are sorted and we save a fortune. I could be oversimplifying it, but that's how it feels. Right, okay. Swan Park, rats in Swan Park. I go to Swan Park quite often and I've never seen a rat in the park. I did see one once down at the water next to the car park by the River Estuary. Good morning, Greg. On the way to work this morning, driving on the limit at 80, an N driver flew past me 5 kilometres up the road. I caught up with them. Probably good enough driver, but shouldn't be doing it. Thanks, Danny, for that. How ironic, Donegal County Council asking people to cut vegetation from around their house to prevent fire as the fire service is reduced. You couldn't make it up, they conclude. Someone from Buncrana should go out to Tory Island and get the Tory clay from a certain family who lives there and place the clay around Swan Park. The rats will flee off. Do you think? It'd be an interesting experiment, actually. I'm not doubting it for a second, but a lot of that is belief, sort of stroke faith-based, and I know the clay that you're talking of. It would be really interesting to see if it makes any difference. Are the cancelled tenants living in defective concrete block houses in the Letterkenny area going to be prioritised for housing in the new proposed €350 social housing development? I'm not sure about that. Whoever made this decision to downgrade the fire service in Donegal ought to be named so everyone in the county knows who put them at risk. This covering up and not naming the person is the very reason why everything is going wrong in this county. It has to stop. OK, we'll be back with more after the break. Now, you would know that Pat Harvey, the former chief executive of the Northwestern Health Board and former general manager of Letterkenny University Hospital, was on with us last week. During the live conversation, I suggested Pat might call back up because we were talking about the reimbursement scheme from the HSC and hips and knees and stuff, and we just didn't have the time to talk about the health service. But there's very few people that would have such an insight as to where we were, where we are at, etc. So, Pat, I appreciate you accepting the invite and coming back up to us.
You're very welcome.
Right, so... The way the hospital is now, as it's being reported, and indeed the HSC released their statements, we have situations where every weekend and during the week as well, people are facing, you know, 9, 10, 15, in some cases 24 hours waits at Letterkenny University Hospital. Now, again, the caveat is when they get into the hospital, to a man and woman almost, they say the service is excellent, the staff are fantastic, they run off their feet. But how was it when you were... the boss at Letterkenny University Hospital. Was it like that? I mean, what was the time frame we're talking?
Well, you were down to hours.
Yeah.
So I don't want to come across as somebody who's knocking the existing system and management and people who work very hard at providing a service that has to be provided. But I have a simple view, which is that if you start from a position whereby 5 hours, 10 hours, 20 hours is acceptable... and I know that nobody thinks it's acceptable, but by default it's acceptable, then you're starting from the wrong position. I'm inclined to say we just must get it down to a couple of hours, and whatever it takes to get it service provided in 2 hours or 1 hour or whatever it is, you do it. I mean, you wouldn't dream of postponing a cesarean section for a couple of hours. You wouldn't dream of postponing cardiac arrest response for a couple of hours. So you have to start from a position which says nothing beyond a couple of hours is acceptable, and whatever it takes to do and provide the service in a timely way, you do it. So, for instance, if you take it that there's tens of thousands who attend every year, half of those maybe are minor injuries, what are they doing in there if you can't cope with them? So that just eliminates half the numbers.
So you're talking like a minor injuries clinic close?
Minor injuries unit close by. And I know they have plans for that, but it's needed in a very urgent fashion.
But just in relation to, Pat, you know, The most recent press release that I had eyes on last weekend came from the HSC, and they talked of every bed in the hospital being full. They talked of really quite sick people who needed to be admitted to those beds, but there was no beds for them. And they sort of obviously did the usual thing, if you can go to your GP or NIADOC, please do. But it seems that even if you stripped out those that might benefit from going to a minor injuries clinic, the hospital still is over capacity in terms of very sick people that need to get into beds, getting those who aren't as sick out of those beds. Do you know what I mean? So I think are you confident that if we removed sort of the soft tissue stuff and what have you, that the hospital would be able to cope?
No, I'm not saying that alone would do it. I'm just saying whatever it takes.
Yeah.
Just whatever it takes. It takes a hugely concerted, concentrated team effort to make sure that nobody waits beyond a few hours. And you might say, well, that's an overly simplistic response, but if you start from any other position, if you start from a different centre of gravity, then you finish up in a different place. So you have to start with saying, it's just not good enough that people have to wait for hour after hour after hour after hour. And I'm saying it again because that's the way it feels to people, after hour. It's just not acceptable. So we don't allow a lot of other services to be put through such grief and pain. Why are we somehow or other, by default, accepting that it's great to get from 15 hours down to 10 hours when you should be down to 2 hours.
Yeah.
So it's just a different centre of gravity.
I mean, the targets for getting over 70 seen is crazy. I think 7 or 8 hours. Yeah. You know, that's the target. So if you meet that, it's supposed to be all good. A lot is put down to an increased population. It's a very, very busy hospital. An ageing population, which is fantastic, right? But more presentations with respiratory illnesses and all that kind of stuff. And I know you're conscious of not criticising anyone in situ at the moment. What I'm trying to figure out from someone who's in there, the problems down at the hospital now, how much of is it down to changing demographics, more people going to the hospital, and how much...
Yeah, a lot of it's down to changing demographics, and a lot of it's down to increased demand, and it's a different profile of demand than was there in my time, and there's a lot more that's provided in the hospital, a lot more consultants, a lot more nurses and so on. So a lot of it, what has happened, is very good, and they have to be complimented for the success they've had over the years. But you're always going to be confronted. In 20 years' time, you'll have somebody in here chatting about the demand being in excess of the supply. There'll always be a demand in excess of supply. Mm-hmm. You're always trying to make the best.
But we have sight of that, though, Pat, right? We know that people are living longer. We know that people are going to need additional care. You know what I mean? We're firefighting now the current situation. But as I say, we knew what was coming down the tracks, and we know what's coming in 20 years. The people want, you know, the planning and the resources to sort of deal with what we know is here now and what is coming, rather than tinkering around the edges, it seems.
Sure that it's just tinkering around the edges. I mean, the job of hospital management is to make sure that you get the optimum impact from all your clinicians, your consultants, your nurses, whatever it is. That's what hospital management is about, is making sure you allow them to make the greatest impact. If there's anything that's causing them not to make the greatest impact because of systems or organisation or culture or whatever it may be, you must tackle it.
So say when you were in situ there, Pat, and let's say it probably happened that something happened whereby the queues appeared to get longer, and you were, you know, as the general manager, what do you do? Who do you call into the office? Do you go down to the ED? How does the general, in your time, and maybe it's the same now, how does the general manager manage a situation where you walk into the ED, it's absolutely wedged, the overflow is wedged, and you've got people there that are sitting there for 24 hours? So, you know, what did you do when situations like that raise their heads?
Well, can I digress just for a minute? One of the things that we were very conscious of is that when the HSE was introduced, it's funny how some things make a big difference in the background. When the HSE was introduced, we wondered whether it was wise to remove the boards and the accountability locally to politicians and to consultants and to nurses. I mean, back in the health board days, once a month, at least, if not twice a month, I had to stand up in a public forum and account for my stewardship to local public representatives, whom I have huge respect for. They're the people who are elected to represent the public, and account for my stewardship and say, well, why were people waiting for 3 hours or 2 hours or 5 hours? Or why was there dirt behind the door in the physio department in Cairns on a... Whatever it may be, we were accountable for it, and we had to stand up and be accountable. I think that sharp focus of accountability to public consultants, public nurses, public representatives, is something that has been lost to the system, because it's one big animal at the moment of a HSE. I never was in favour of a HSE.
But it still is down the road from us. It's still one building with a management team and with staff within it. You know, so there still is presumably autonomy to make some changes and to improve things.
Yeah.
You know, even within the animal that is the HSE.
Well, I suppose to answer the question you asked me, and not to avoid it, you just have to get the right players, the people who can make a material difference to the way things operate. You just have to get them in there and work with them and work as a team. I mean, I spent the weekend in Limerick with the Donegal under-16s football crowd who won the All-Ireland, and credit to them and congratulations to them. You want to see them working as a team. You want to see the way they row in with each other, back each other up, past each other, to relieve people. That sort of team spirit is what's needed. In any organisation, you need the systems, but you need the culture, the people who work together. So let nobody say to me that you don't have enough brains down that hospital, because you do. They're wonderful people. I mean, as you say, once you get in the door, it's just wonderful. If they kind of are coordinated and caused to be cohesive and so on, I think they can pack a mighty punch.
And is that the manager's job? It's not necessarily the one manager, the management structure up and down.
It's management's job, not to personalise it, but it's
management's difficult, job. Is it more difficult now to deal with nurses, consultants, doctors because of unions? If you know what I mean,
I've never had a thing about unions. I've always thought that unions typically are people you can work with, whether it's the INMO, the AMO, or SIPTU, or FORSA. I've always thought that they're better off in the room than not in the room, I've always felt that any time they raised an issue with me, they generally had something legitimate to say. So they're not the enemy. They can generally be aligned.
And I'm not saying they are. I'm just trying to ask every question to try and cover things that people have said over the past, if that makes sense. Yeah. There seems to be a particular issue at the start of the week, getting people out of hospital at the weekend. What in your experience, what's going on there? Now, I've known people that are perfectly healthy, thank God, because of the work of the hospital.
Yeah.
They're sitting there waiting to be discharged.
Well, what's the answer to that? I mean, it's planning, it's organisation, it's coordination, it's teamwork, it's all those various elements that have to be dovetailed together to make it work.
But I find myself drawn then back to your footballing analogy here about how the team is being run.
Well, you're dying for me to say something like...
I'm really not.
Management's fault.
No, I'm really not. I'm just... what I'm trying to do is... No, I genuinely am not. And I want to be really clear on that. But I do understand, Pat, how it might seem that I am. But I'm trying to figure out locally, is it a lost case? Or locally, can we do stuff locally to improve the situation and the experiences of people listening to the show? So if my question seemed to sort of go back to that, right? But or maybe the hospital is a victim of the HSE. But I'm not trying to blame individuals. Do you understand where I'm coming from, Pat?
Well,
can we make a difference locally to improve the situation down there? Or does someone else need to come in or Sealta needs to make changes or what?
You can't sidestep where responsibility rests. Responsibility rests with management. Sometimes there's confusion as to who management is or who they are. Sometimes people who are in senior positions point the finger and say, well, that's management's fault, as if they were not in management. You know, a ward sister is a very powerful person. A ward charge nurse is a very powerful person. Consultants can flip services upside down at their will. So they're all involved in management, but you can't sidestep the central hospital executive and the hospital management and director of nursing and general manager. Ultimately, the buck rests there, and the hospital will either thrive and flourish under their guidance or it won't. So Sean Murphy and the director of nursing are excellent people with a huge amount of experience who have brought the services on massively over the years. But you cannot sidestep where at the end of the day the buck rests. I suppose that's the simple answer to your question. But I don't mean that as a criticism. Hospitals in the general management literature would be regarded as the most complex of organisations to run. Like universities, they're the most complex. Unlike any other business organisation where you have a boss and you have people who are reporting to them, the line structure is very clear. In a hospital, you know, you've got all these people who have clinical autonomy in their own right, and you're trying to herd all of that into a cohesive whole. And it's a big challenge. It's a big challenge. And the bigger the hospital gets, the more complex it becomes and the more challenging it becomes.
You mentioned earlier on, at least once a month, sometimes twice a month, you had to go in front of public representatives who presumably were able to articulate the concerns they had or the concerns that were passed up the chain by those that elected them. How significant was that in keeping everybody on their toes?
I think it's the single greatest ingredient of success that's missing from the existing system. I mean, when Bernard McGlinchey stood up at a public meeting, or Noel McGinley, or Bernard McGuinness, or other public representatives, Paddy Hart and so on, and asked you to account for your stewardship, you felt you had to account for your stewardship.
Mm-hmm.
And rightly so. We're there as public servants to represent or to serve the public. So your antenna was very clearly honed. You were anticipating what might even come up. You were aware that there was a waiting time in A&E department. You were aware that there were problems in Dunloe or whatever it may be, or in community care, whatever it is. You were just more sharply honed in that sense. Now, you might say, well, that's local politicians looking after local politics, and you were missing something from a central drive. And there's a certain amount of truth in that there, but you have to be accountable to your local place. I mean, I'm not saying that the HSE doesn't have a purpose. You need somebody centrally commissioning the service and saying, here are the rules and here are the number of hospitals we'll have and here are the specialties we'll have and so on. But leave it to the local people to play out locally.
Well, with that in mind, you were head of the North Western Health Board. Now we have decisions being made by Sealta based in Galway. And they make no bones about it. They want centres of excellence. They say, if certain treatments you're going to have to travel and what have you. But we are the most remote from that decision-making position. And we've seen it when governments are based in Dublin or Belfast, often the furthest you are away from it, you know, the less attention you get. Do you believe that Sealta operating out of Galway is worse for us than the North Western Health Board was?
I think you have to have a certain geographic size and population. So Sealta in its own right is good. I think you have to have somebody centrally calling and making the rules about how we play. But I think there should be an organisation locally, accountable locally, for what we do and how we do it. So take, for instance, higher education. The HEA gets a budget from the minister, does a deal with the universities like ATU. ATU has its own board, is accountable for its own performance, you know, succeeds or fails in its own right. They're not confused by being part of all the over all universities. So we need somebody centrally to say, yes, here are the rules by which you play. And some things are better done centrally, like screening and so on. But here are the rules by which you play, then get on with it locally.
Yeah. That being said,
to go back to your football analogy.
Yeah.
FA, they make the rules centrally about how the game is played, but you play it locally and you're accountable locally and you're accountable to your own local patch.
Yeah. And even under the higher education spending, we still have, unfortunately, a lower invest per student in this part of the country than we do elsewhere. It would be very interesting for someone to go in, and I'm not sure it's ever done, to the ED. What's going on? Who's in there that doesn't really need to be in there? What's the percentages wise? How are people prioritised? Presumably that's simple enough. It's on who needs the... But what happens then? What's the hold-up then in getting through the ED? What happens then when you're putting a chair in the hall? Or what happens when you're on it? Why are you on a trolley? What is the, where is the blockage or what's holding stuff up? Has that been done, do you think? And how worthwhile might an actual, you know, investigation into how the ED is run, how beneficial might that be?
I'm sure it has been done. I'm sure it's been done multiple times. I'm still going to go back to the starting point, which is that anybody who's waiting more than 2 hours is unacceptable. So if you start to accept that it's good enough to have a delay, then everything revolves around that in your thinking. You have to start from a position which says, we're not going to have it. We're just not going to have that delay. It's just not good enough. It's not good enough that somebody comes in. Somebody described to me the weekend where they had cut their wrist and there were a heavy bleeding and they were sent through triage and so on. There was nothing the triage nurse could do except say, wait. The person almost becomes seriously ill. You say, well, that's just not good enough. It's just not good enough. So I don't know how we can start from a position where the centre of gravity is, we may have long delays here, as distinct from a centre of gravity says, we're just not going to have them. Whatever it takes, whatever it takes.
Because we do know.
A very simple answer.
Well, it isn't, because we see hospitals around the country that operate differently. And there is different circumstances, but they're also dealing with different demographics. And there aren't people on trolleys. There aren't massive delays. You know, what is working in other hospitals that needs to be employed elsewhere?
Well, the simple answer to it is that if you take places like Limerick, they might say that the population is too great for one hospital to try and carry the burden of. And there's a lot of truth in that. If they compare Limerick with Beaumont, Beaumont has more beds for the population than Limerick has. So there's going to be fallout from that. But you could resolve maybe problems like Limerick by saying, well, why aren't we relying more on Nina and Ennis or whatever it may be? Why are we not able to do some things that will relieve the pressure on the A&E department? And I'm not giving you the answers because I'm not sure what the answers are, because I'm not involved in what the answers. I'm just saying that if you start from a position that 10 hours is good enough or 12 hours.
So then is that a mindset issue, then? An ethos? An ethos within a building or organisation?
It's to do
because you seem to be saying if there is a will, there's a way.
I think I'm saying that, yeah.
Yeah. But so that means
you can't afford to have it otherwise.
Yeah. If you went into that hospital, three things instantly that you would... Firstly, you start campaigning for an injuries clinic, right? But what's the one or two things, if it's possible, that you would go in there and do that you believe might have an impact? And we'll focus on the ED element of things.
Well, all the pressure in the hospital gravitates to the A&E department because there's a limit on what any other department can do, whether it's an inpatient ward or whatever it may be. So there are limitations as to what they can cope with. And by default, everything lands down in the A&E department. So I'd say I'd have to kind of have a look at that and say, why are we comfortably saying everything lands down in the A&E department? Once you get in, you're grand, but until you get in, there's a problem. I'd be wanting to look at that.
Well, people are getting letters from the doctors, their GP, saying this person has extremely high blood pressure, suffering from a headache, blah, 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 but they still have to be triaged through the ED. That letter becomes irrelevant once they get in there.
Yeah.
That might help in some regard to get people through.
Yeah, but I'm not giving you the answer you're looking for because...
No, I'm not looking for any answer.
But you need the people who know what they're at.
Yeah.
Whether it's the A&E consultants and the rest of the team of consultants in the hospital and the rest of the senior nurses and the nurses all need to be kind of dovetailing towards making sure that we don't have waiting times in A&E.
Yeah, like
whatever it takes.
All right. Do you think you could make a difference down there?
I would say.
And what I mean by that is I'm not really necessarily asking you to talk yourself up, but maybe that you would feel it's not a lost cause and something could be done, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think people need to row in with the staff and row in with the management and bring renewed focus to the A&E department and say, this is just not good enough. We're going to have to crack this nut, so let's go at it and let's not get distracted from it until we get it cracked in some shape or form. And that I'd probably get any amount of criticism later on today by saying, Pat, you went up there and you suggested that it was all very simple to resolve. It's not simple to resolve. It's anything but simple to resolve. But if you accept a position that ours are good enough, then you're not going to get it resolved.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Right. Pat Harvey, former chief executive of the Northwestern Health Board and former general manager at Letterkenny General Hospital. Thanks for your time.